papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting...
It's the Media Project, a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in the news media and how folks are faring in the newsrooms that are so challenged these days. I'm Rex Smith of The Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union. I'm here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, now vice president of the New York Press Association. Judy, Judy, Judy.
And I am so happy to be here.
Are you really? Barbara Lombardo is here, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record, now teaching at UAlbany.
Hi, and a happy new year around the corner.
Happy new year is going to be with us very shortly. Ira Fussfeld, the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman and affiliated publications in Kingston, New York State's first capital.
Good day, Rex, and everybody. Glad to be with you.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to have the gang all here in the
Kingston,
studio.
Kingston, the first capital, huh? A little bit of trivia in the show today.
We'll show you the Senate House.
Isn't that something? You just get all kinds of insight when you join the media project here. Let's see, what else can we offer? Anyway, we'll see if we have some insight into media issues. One of the topics that we wanted to talk about here was about how we confront the future in an ever-changing environment. You know, we have seen the decline of print in our lifetimes. We are now seeing a change in the media radio landscape. Terrestrial radio, that is all these towers around the world, is drawing a lot less attention. But I just read a statistic that says spoken word listening. Let's think about what that means. Spoken word listening. So that's what people are listening to us today. But it's not just by the towers going along. It is now podcasts, especially downloading digital. That apparently has grown so much during daytime hours, in fact, that it is a terrific opportunity for the media. And I'm just wondering if that might be one of the solutions. Or what other solutions might there be as we look at the newsrooms that we all came from, which were text-based newspaper newsrooms? What would you be doing if you were running a newsroom right now to try to reach people? How would you try to be growing your audience at this point? What's a good solution? Is audio the next solution for newspapers, or what's the right next strategy?
Well, a number of newspapers and other media non-print outlets are already into podcasting. Predictably, the larger ones that have more money to experiment and do it right and have people dedicated for it. As the old fogey in the room, though, I just find myself constantly saying, who is listening to all, who has the time to listen to all this stuff? There are so many podcasts out there. There are so many other places where you can get information that the potential for revenue is just split in a huge number of ways, and I don't know how or if it can be paid off. It's just too much out there. Who's listening to this stuff?
You know, a really good podcast can be a good learning experience. I find that if I really want to know about a subject, I will track down a good podcast on it, and it gives you an opportunity to listen to someone discuss in depth the kinds of complex issues that our society faces today. I just have a limited amount of time to listen to podcasts, but as long as I'm choosy, I think it can be really productive in terms of what I gain from it. The question I often have, though, is it more efficient or is it easier for a newsroom to talk out a story rather than type out a story? Because, if you ever watch a reporter work, they can spend 3 hours on writing a lead. Would it be far more efficient for them to just talk out their stories? And if that's the way they're going to get people to learn the content, maybe that is the way to go. So there are people who are visual learners, there are people who are audio learners. And I'm thinking our society is pushing most of our people towards the audio video kind of learning mode.
I have a question and then an opinion about, to answer your question, Rex. Spoken word listening, does that include...
Isn't that a great phrase?
clicking on the Washington Post and
yes.
I choose to have it read to me
That's
in,
right.
in an AI voice, the story that was written. Is that also spoken word listening?
Yes, that is correct. Yep.
So I think that that is a great advancement, as scary as I find AI, because the stories are well-crafted, which kind of addresses Judy's suggestion about just winging it when you're reporting on a story orally. That could be problematic. But being able to just click and have them talk to me while I'm doing something else, I think is an advantage. I think that the future for the media is being relevant, and that no matter whether we're presenting it as a written word that they have to read, that's not spoken, or it's spoken word, that figuring out, especially on the local level, how to make ourselves important and relevant to the community, that's what really matters.
So to be relevant, you need to provide news that people need, right?
Right, and then figuring out what that is. And it could be a tricky to get the word out, but there seems to be successful word of mouth using social media to reach people. And if people start talking about, oh, did you see this? Or they're following that issue that's important to us. I think that's what we need to be doing more of.
I worry about the spoken word part when you talk about talking out a story, because one of the reasons that it takes a long time sometimes to write a story is because you're trying to get it exactly right, especially if it's a sensitive topic. You know, we spoke in the last week's show about George Stephanopoulos on ABC using the word rape with respect to Donald Trump's conviction in a civil case for sex abuse. And oftentimes when you talk to a reporter who's just come back with a notebook full of notes on a story, and the reporter is very fluid in discussing it, but then when you sit down to write it, you get a lot more precision and you avoid the potential for libel or for error that might come in just fluidly talking out a story. This is one of the advantages we always had in print. You know, we could take time to get it right, as opposed to the poor folks in radio and television who had to do it live. But it is the more immediacy is one of the things that people really like. The
consumers
like.
Can I just address, in speaking just now, this is an example of why that's problematic. So in a civil case, conviction is not the correct term.
Mm-hmm.
You're not convicted. And I think we mentioned about Donald Trump's conviction, and it was in a civil case, that it would be a finding of liability.
Liability, that's right. He's liable, not convicted. Exactly.
Yeah, so I don't think this raises our concern to George Stephanopoulos' term.
But it's precisely right. Yeah, you use the wrong word and you could have a problem. But the problem, too, is that it's expensive to create the kind of content that really matters to people, that'll make a difference, that will differentiate you. Because, you know, it used to be that we would say, well, we're the place where we gather all the information if you need to know what's going on in your community. But now, you know, Google does that for people. If it's summertime in Saratoga Springs, Barbara, it used to be that the Saratogian was the place where people would want to know what's going on in my community. But now they can just Google it, can't they?
They can just Google it, but Google is looking through existing sources to be able to give you an answer.
Which might be the actual press releases from SPAC and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right.
So let's break it down again. I'm not talking about the larger institutions. I'm talking about mid to small institutions saying to themselves, you know, these podcasts, they may be the way of the future. We ought to get involved with it. Are the numbers of people who are going to put together a podcast on a daily basis or even on a couple of days a week basis, are the numbers going to be doable when you probably have to hire people to do it if it's going to be done correctly? And if your potential audience is just not that large.
Yeah, that's a valid point. We did an experiment for a few weeks only at the Times Union a dozen years ago, say we would come out of our afternoon meeting and I would do a little live video presentation.
Oh, I've done those too.
Yeah,
here's what's coming up in the paper tomorrow. Here's what we're following in the newsroom. And, you know, we looked at the numbers, there were maybe two dozen people looking.
Well, that was 30 seconds too. I mean, it wasn't an extended video.
I did about 3.5 minutes, yeah. But nobody wanted to have to make an appointment. That was appointment viewing, which people don't want anymore. Everybody wants to see stuff when they want to see it.
You know, the spoken word, it uses a robot to read the content, which I have never embraced the cadence, or there is something off about the narrator. And even though it's getting better, and I imagine someday it's going to be really good, at this point in time, I just can't get through a whole article being read to me by a robot. I almost think it would be worthwhile for somebody to invest in having someone to come in and read.
I don't know. I think they're pretty good. There's some parts of it that are sad and laughable at the same time because they don't know how to pronounce something or they don't know how to deal with the punctuation in a phrase or an acronym.
How do you pronounce that creek that goes through Saratoga Springs? What do you call that creek?
The Cater-Rosseras?
Oh, yeah.
The Cater-Rosseras, but people there don't usually say that. They say Cater-Ross.
Cater-Ross, yeah, right.
So that's how we know if you're local or not.
Uh-huh. If you add
if
the
you
extra
say it wrong.
Yeah. You want to say it wrong. It's like the city of Buffalo is actually pronounced with only two syllables, you know, Buffalo, if you're from there.
I had Buffalo. A journalism teacher at Ohio State who told us if you say Pawtucket, Rhode Island, they know you don't belong. It's Pawtucket.
Pawtucket. Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a lesson to always ask how a place is pronounced.
And what's the largest city in Kentucky? This is not a quiz for geography, folks.
Another trivia question.
The early capital of Kingston.
No, you just have to kind of swallow it. It's Louisville.
Louisville.
Yeah, but us print people never used to have to be worried about how to pronounce anything.
Right.
It's one of the advantages we had over radio and TV. And we never had to really worry about combing our hair either.
Well, I just think that the potential here is it's another example of us in the media or we in the media being behind the eight ball and we're playing catch up. And there's too many others who do these things well and have been doing them for a while to make the existence of something new a welcoming one.
What is difficult, I think, is figuring out, though, and you alluded to this, Ira, what the content is that is so essential that people are going to want to continue to engage with the local media. I'm worried that we have been left with generations that don't really have the habit of news consumption and really don't care much about knowing what the town board is doing or what the county is up to in their jurisdiction and figure they'll just get by. And that really spells doom for a lot of local media.
You know, I think that started when we stopped publishing honor rolls and cafeteria menus and wedding announcements and engagement announcements.
I love that answer.
You know, and Little League box scores.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kind of a whole generation. It was something special. They clipped it out and they kept it. And they became associated with the newspaper and they grew up with it. And we don't do that anymore.
Boy, is that true. I think Ira and I can both attest to there was a period in time when our newspapers were owned by a company whose CEO was gleefully firing sports editors at their local newspapers because they didn't get the Little League scores in.
Well, I don't know. Again, I've not been in a newsroom in a long time. I don't know that we've stopped printing Little League scores because we've made it a target and say we don't need these anymore. I just believe that they don't have the time to do it. I look at my old paper and I see a lot of local stuff, bowling scores and the like, but not nearly as much as we used to because people are not sending them in anymore.
And people used to clip those things out and put them on the refrigerator and they'd put them in their scrapbook for their children's high school graduation.
But I'll tell you where there was a mistake, and you alluded to it, is the elimination of wedding announcements and engagements. And they didn't eliminate them, but they started charging for them the way they charge for obits. And they lost all of this content that was good for readership and people buying the newspaper because they thought it was too expensive to give it away for free.
Because there is a place to get that news for free using Facebook or...
Not necessarily engagements and weddings. So we have solved the problem. Bring that back. We will resurrect local news.
Oh, boy.
Is that possible? I mean, why isn't somebody doing that? Why are there not local entrepreneurs who are putting out hyper-local content like that that people want to see? And will that actually happen?
When somebody is getting married, for instance, or did well in something, they're putting that up on their own sites or the sites that belong to whatever organization that is. They don't need us to get that word out.
Hmm. And so the accumulation of it, which used to be the value proposition for a newspaper, yes, we have your comics, we have your crossword, and we have the results of the local bridge club as well. That used to be the value proposition. You could get that all for 50 cents.
Well, do you also think that with changing times and the way neighborhoods are changing and communities are changing, that having a wedding announcement for somebody isn't as meaningful anymore? You don't know the people. as you might have years ago in a smaller town.
But the difficulty is that what we've left people with then is the nationalization of the news. And so the only news media that people see is network television. And as that is especially prone to bias these days, people feel alienated from what's not going on in their own backyard.
Well, another moneymaker and something that people used to be interested in turning to their newspaper for would be obituaries. And I don't think it killed the newspapers when we started to charge for the obituaries, although I found that an unhappy switch. But nowadays, you could just go to the funeral homes and check to see if somebody you know has passed away.
That's too much work. The obituaries, the funeral homes don't mind paying for the obituaries because they pass the cost along to the family. And you know, the old joke about my paper and probably all small town newspapers, if it wasn't for the obituaries and the police news, nobody would buy the paper and read the paper. And I think it's true in the sense that the obituaries still have a place and it's a dominant piece of real estate in the newspaper, even though we're charging them now to have it.
And it does, however, speak to the age of the readership of these organizations, newspapers, whether you're reading them online or in print. The folks who are paying attention to the obits, of course, are the people who are in the age category, who are
checking to see if they're in there.
I know a lot of a lot more people in the obit page than I did 20 years ago.
But the services we offered back then almost created a sense of community in our communities that is not there anymore. We're divided. I don't know whether, you know, my best friend's daughter got married or not, unless they sent me, if I'm not friends with them on Facebook or they didn't send me an invitation. There are so many things about my community that I might have known 25 years ago that I do not know now.
But let's go back to the bread and butter of local coverage, of going to the county courthouse or the town hall and covering those meetings so you would know who is it who's clearing the land out here and why is that? Is that a subdivision on this property or is that somebody building a gas station where that fine old Victorian used to stand? There is no one doing that anymore. And if the community doesn't know about that, is that a business opportunity or is that just will people just be satisfied to be ignorant about their own local community? I worry that the basic service of journalism that local media provided has become an anachronism, that people don't even care anymore. And that's part of the sort of disillusion of the fabric of community.
Or they care, but not enough to pay for it.
Well, yeah, I guess that's right. Because even paying reporters as little as we did, or the correspondents who I used to pay $25 to go to a town board meeting, my goodness, even that went by the wayside.
You know, they'll start to care if something happens that they really don't like a huge solar farm on a parkland or something like that, but that doesn't happen very often. But those are the kinds of instances that can propel people to clamor for independent journalism, credible journalism, things that they can actually trust, take to the bank and know that that's true. A lot of the things that are happening in these small communities are done deals by the time people become aware of it. So you can find out if your town board or your village board posts its meetings online, but they don't all do that. And oftentimes those are very brief roundups of what happened.
And as Ira says, that's extra work.
My favorite example of the peril of this came about a decade ago from the Los Angeles Times, which won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing corruption in the town of Day, a small town which was paying its city manager $250,000 a year and paying every member of the 5-member city council $125,000 a year for meeting once a month. I mean, this was a great expose by the Los Angeles Times, and they won a Pulitzer Prize. A buddy of mine was the veteran reporter they brought in with the young reporter who had uncovered this because the town was spending millions and millions of dollars to enrich this little band of local people who had taken over the town. But the irony of it is that if the LA Times had not given up local coverage, this wouldn't have happened in the first place. It's because there was no coverage of the town of Day that the corruption in the town of Day occurred, which corruption the LA Times eventually uncovered by stumbling across it and then reported. But when you lose this power of the local press, that's when you have higher taxes, more corrupt government, and in fact, communities begin to falter. There has actually been research showing that to be true. So I guess we're thumping ourselves in the back by saying, gosh, it was great when we had those. But the fact is, I think that there could emerge. I mean, my hope is that the ecosystem is beginning to develop that could give us small-scale, hyper-local journalism, perhaps in a non-profit situation, that will restore some of that hyper-local reporting that people really value.
Right. It takes work. I mean, it's not something that just magically appears, but there are enough people out there that care that they just need somebody to organize it.
Another platform that is impacted, and has been impacted even more so than the traditional ones that we're talking about, are weekly newspapers, which are disappearing at a greater rate of speed than our daily newspapers. And the weekly papers served many purposes, but not the least of which was cover the small town stuff or the minuscule news that the dailies used to cover. And now they're going away. I used to predict that as daily newspapers go, that weekly newspapers would find their legs and get even stronger, and that has not happened.
Yes, I thought, actually, when I was the editor of the Troy paper in the early 90s, I remember thinking, you know, someday this is going to be a great weekly.
Yeah, it still might happen.
It still could happen, but so far, what a lot of these companies that have bought up so many papers are doing is they're simply gutting the local papers and leaving a nameplate and filling it with other stuff, which isn't as valuable. But this is the model that they teach in business school, of course. This is where the term cash cow comes from. You extract all the cash that you can from an asset that's depreciating in value until you've depleted it.
You know, there are some weeklies out there that are doing well, but particularly the ones in rural areas without a lot of commerce, they are the ones who are struggling because they don't have their advertising bases evaporated. And when their subscribers go away, they don't have any revenue streams to really count on. But I'm seeing some that are really holding on, especially if they're small family-owned weeklies, tend to fare better than those that aren't family-owned. So
one of the most stunning statistics that I've seen lately comes from a further analysis of the News Deserts numbers that are now held by Medill School at Northwestern University. And what it found is that while Donald Trump won the presidency by 1.5%, he had a very narrow edge over Kamala Harris in the popular vote, he would run up margins of 90% in news deserts. The places where he got the highest margin coincided with the places where there is no news coverage. I don't think that's because the local media weren't there to cover him, because those little weeklies wouldn't have been covering a presidential race anyway. It's because of that local stitching together that the local media provided. It's because of the general disillusionment of people in the news deserts that is exacerbated by the loss of media coverage. It's those places where people feel most alienated which gave rise to the strength of Donald Trump. So it's a chicken and egg thing. You know, are these communities, have they lost their voice in the media because of disillusionment, or are they disillusioned because they don't have anybody kind of tracking what's going on in their communities? But it does help us to understand that there is a direct line between the loss of local media and the rise of the alienation that gave us a second Trump presidency. For whatever it's worth, it's just a very interesting analysis that I was reading last week that suggests that we may still not be out of the out of the woods by this account.
Man, you are a Debbie Downer today. And as we head into the new year, let's
talk. I'll be willing to give the readers a tip. If you still read a daily newspaper and your newspaper still gets legal notices, read them faithfully every day, because they're great sources for news of what just the sort of thing that we were talking about. If they're opening, they're soliciting bids for a project or such and such, you can find the core of a news story in the legal notices.
Because that's what you always used to tell your reporters to do,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first thing you do in the morning, check the legal notices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great thing. And I presume those reporters that still are on the job are still doing that.
I couldn't tell you that.
And there are apps like that, I forget what it's called now, the Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the Neighborhood apps, yeah.
Yes.
The Neighborhood sites, yeah, whatever they are.
Whatever they're called.
Yeah.
I guess. And if I were a reporter now, or if I were an editor directing reporters, I would be looking at those things because that's what you can hear about or what's going on in the neighborhoods that might be of interest. It could be burglaries, it could be constructions, things that people are talking about of concern to them that you could jump on and cover as an issue.
That point was made by one of our listeners who heard us last week saying that if you want to know where the barn is on fire, you don't go to Facebook, you go to local media. I think you might have said that, Barbara. And Morgan in Fort Edward wrote and said, personally, it's the opposite. If I hear a bunch of sirens or see smoke, I go straight to Facebook.
Personally, it was actually Judy who said that.
Oh.
And I said what the letter writer said.
You go to social media? Oh,
wait a minute.
Judy's
can
fault.
I defend my point here? Because sure,
it was the other girl.
I might go to Facebook, and then there'll be a lot of inane chatter back and forth about what road it's on and if it's really on fire, and then we'll get some history piece, and we won't get a definitive answer about whether the thing is actually on fire or whether that picture they posted with the flames coming out was actually this year or 10 years ago. So for a definitive, credible source of information, I'm not finding Facebook to be my friend.
That could be true, but the point remains that the local newspaper is not the source for that information.
For breaking news.
For not instantaneous news. I think we all need to be a little bit more patient, as editors have been. If you really want to get the real story, you let the reporter go out, find out the information, come back and tell you.
So if you want to join this conversation, media@wamc.org. And that is the end of our program for the year, folks.
Oh, Happy New Year to everybody.
Isn't that something?
Well, I don't want to end with disagreeing with Judy.
Okay, then. That's all you get.
Too late.
Come back next week.
I'll come back next year.
Okay. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina, for getting us here. And to you folks for listening. We'll see you again next year on The Media Project.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.